My name is Clancy Imeslund, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm very glad to be here tonight, safe and sane and sober, as I like to say, because I didn't used to be, and I may not be again sometime. Because AA is made up of imperfect people, all of them, and if they don't take certain actions, little by little they can drift back, and it happens to better people than you and me. I want to comment just briefly on the 10-minute speakers. I was pretty turned off by Pat's talk many years ago when she talked about geography, but now that she's into emotions, I wish she'd go back and talk about geography. Really, just I would much rather be around Rhonda the robot than Carolyn the chameleon. But I'm not judging, I'm just coming. No, fine talk. And John Deere did a fine 10-minute talk and talked about the worst things can happen to anybody in sobriety, being divorced and losing their job. Let me tell you something worse than that. Not being divorced and staying on the job. That's the test, Slim. But I'm very happy that we are gathered. Incidentally, something in passing, I heard our secretary discussing this at the back. Tonight, every chair in the synagogue has been taken out and is being used and is filled. So all the seats in here filled, and all the chairs filled. There are 950 people at this meeting tonight. Which is the largest, I'm sure the largest regular AA meeting ever held in the history of the world, outside of a convention or a special occasion. So, it really is, it's wonderful that we're all here. And it's hard to remember that it wasn't very long ago that there was no place for people like you and me to go to. And today, Alcoholics Anonymous, the best thing that's ever happened to people like us, continues to be under attack, and today some people reject it without trying it, some people try it briefly and say it doesn't work, some people come here and stay sober a long time and feel good and think they no longer need it and drift out. And it just is that when you're involved in AA, you wonder how that can happen. But if you want to know how that can happen, just get uninvolved for a little while, and little by little you see how it can happen. Because what happens is, again and again, I, the individual who withdraw, I'm not changing. They are changing. They are looking worse. Because, as been said many, many times by people smarter than I, that alcoholism truly is a disease of perception. And reality is as I see it, and truth is as I see it, and that's why you can't count on any abstract truth or honesty or wisdom, because it means different things to different people. I was talking recently about on the traditions, and I mentioned something about the difficulty that AA had. It's the difficulty we all have all the time. The concept that somehow, if my motives are pure and I'm aiming towards a good goal, I will need no rules because I will be drawn to this goodness. And that is the great curse of all humanity, falling into that trap when you're engaged in what appears to be spiritual progress. Because each individual's perception of where they're going and where they've been and the way to do it changes their approach to it. And that's why everyone in this room will have a different feeling of what is truth. Because as has been said many, many times, truth is, there's no truth. We could, for example, if you all told me that wall was green and you all saw it as green, that wouldn't change my opinion in the slightest. That's a red wall. That isn't a green wall. That's a red wall, and you're either joking me or you're shucking me or you're doing something silly. And yet, when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous with our perception aglow, and they tell us things like that. They don't tell us about the color of walls, but they tell us other things equally as difficult to accept. It's hard to accept because I see it differently and I see it as it is. Now, my sponsor, for example, when I was new, when I finally had a sponsor who was able to superimpose his will over my defenses, he never said that wall is red, but he said things equally as unacceptable to me. He would say, I don't care how it looks to you. Go and apologize to that woman. Why should I apologize to her? Did you hear what she said about me? I don't care. Go apologize to her. You call her a bitch, now apologize. And I'll tell you, it's no more difficult than thinking that wall is green and going over and apologizing. I'm sorry. Bitch. Or the same as saying, I don't care how it looks to you. Don't quit that job. But they're hurting me, and they're using me, and they're abusing me, and they're underpaying me, and they're treating me like crap. I don't care. Go to work until you find a better job. I don't care how it looks to you. Don't let those people run you out of that meeting. You go sit in that meeting.
But God damn it, they don't clink and they don't call on me. They treat me like crap in there and I'll never get to business.
I don't care. Go sit there. And you keep doing that crap. And little by little, the wall takes on a green tinge. And one day there's a green wall there, and you've been given the endless job of finding goofy newcomers who think it's red and convincing them otherwise. And that's the story of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the critical point here, the critical point for you, and there's really two critical points. One is when you feel bad, and one is when you feel good. But outside of those two times, there are no critical points. But there, and people like me, something Pat said, it stuck in my mind tonight because I tried to examine myself. She said she drank because it helped her overcome the pain. I suppose I drank for that reason partially, but that isn't the reason I remember that I recreate. The reason I drank was to fill in the voids in me, because it seemed to me I was deficient somehow in various abilities and ways and comfortable approach to life. And it never struck me that this was a human condition, because it always struck me when I drank and got this momentary euphoria, when I got that instant omnipotence, when I got that feeling of impervious to human beings, it never struck me that this was something really unusual. I always felt I was just catching up, that they were there all along. This was nothing unusual to me. I always thought, I fell into the trap again and again in my life. And I'm sure there are people in this room who have fallen into it, and may be in it tonight, and will fall into it again. And I may fall into it next week, or the next time I feel bad. Because it's something you fall into little by little when you're not feeling right. And that is without ever consciously thinking it, you just feel they are what they seem to be. I am the only one faking it. And that's such an easy thing to fall into. They're what they seem to be. They know what they're doing. They're doing this and they're doing that, and whatever they're doing by choice. I am the only one counterpunching all the time. I'm the only one reacting. I'm the only one who feels things so much. I'm the only one with these holes. I'm the only one who doesn't fill my armor. It's like sitting at King Arthur's round table, and they go around the room, all these knights.
How are you doing?
Fine.
How are you doing?
Fine.
How are you doing?
Fine.
When they come to me, what do you think I'm going to say? You think I'm going to say, I'm afraid.
I'm fine.
And hold that visor shut and hope those son of the bitches don't open it and see what's inside. And when you come to spiritual movements, such as this or others, it's nice, the talk is nice, and there's nice concepts, but you'll notice that there's just kind of a euphoria that comes from thinking it's going to change, but after you hear a little while, it doesn't change. Your old friends come back, and you fall into the next step into the endless trip to nowhere of becoming aware that I am different here too. I've always known I was different out there, and they say, you come to AA and you won't feel different here, but you do feel different here, because they are what they seem to be, and they have one other great advantage I don't have. They are people whose problem is alcohol, and they get together and share their little experiences and how they stop drinking and how well their lives are going, and they all talk about nice things and the spiritual values of returning to God. And I go home at night and lie in the dark and look off in the distance and think, what is wrong with me? Why don't I feel wonderful? I'm sober. Instead, I just makes me feel sadder and sadder. I can feel euphoric briefly, but it doesn't take long before my old pals come back in the night, anxiety and tension and feeling the difference and feeling alone and feeling nobody really cares and feeling that I don't know if I would, I want someone to be close to, and yet I'm afraid if I were close to them, they wouldn't want to be close to me. So you have to kind of keep people at a distance while you want to be close. It's just an endless thing. And it leaves gaping holes in my ability to deal with the world. I either get testy and cross, or I get overreactive, or I get wimpish, or it's a continual battle 50 times a day, which mask to wear in this situation. And I discovered that I was a boy on a ship in Pearl Harbor, early in the Second World War, that a few drinks of alcohol fills those holes better than anything I'd ever heard of before that time or anything I ever found since. No sense in selling them. I'm a World War II veteran. Maybe you would like to think about that. And I'll tell you, I have never had a better friend in my life than alcohol. I have never had a better friend. It still hurts me to this day to hear people get up and say things like, that damn alcohol, it just was so terrible. It's like hearing somebody badmouth an old girlfriend of mine. You know, just, she may be a pig now, but you should have known her then. Because alcohol had the tendency to change the imbalance of my perceptions. And I have never found anything better than that. It does a lot of things for me. I've always, from my early years, certainly a great deal, and even today, when not very much, but once in a while, because there are no emotions I ever had drinking that I don't have now. I hate to tell you that, newcomer, if you think you're going to come here and become omnipotent, you're not. You're going to have the same emotions, you're just going to try and find ways to keep them from becoming lethally obsessive. They're going to be just human emotions, that's what humans have. But one of the emotions that most troubled me in my life is rejection. Not even overt rejection, but implied rejection. Little non-apparent rejections. Little groups of people who gather and don't tell me. A little memo that doesn't go across my desk that used to go across my desk. Little ways of doing things, little ways of actions. Just a glance sometimes can ruin a day when I'm feeling bad. Just... I remember once when I was about I don't know, 5 months sober in the Hollywood group. And a guy was an old timer there. He'd been kind of nice to me, and I was used to that mean because I didn't have much going for me, but I was there because he was, most of the time, guys would be nice to me. I saw him one night, we were going across the parking lot, and he went and kept walking. And he did not answer. He didn't say, "Hello, Clancy, or how you doing, kid," or something. And I was home that night, and I went to bed, and I woke up in the middle, and I thought, I was hitting an abandoned car. And I woke up in the middle, and I thought, they don't really like me. They pretend to like me. I almost got drunk that night. And I found out a couple months later, I asked him about it when I was feeling better. He hadn't seen me. He didn't have his glasses on. But who would think that? All I know is that it doesn't take much. But when I have a few drinks of alcohol, I'm not criticized. I mean, I'm not rejected. I reject. What a difference that makes. It doesn't sound like much at the Rotary Club, but you know what I'm talking about. So why would you want to reject anyone, son? Because, that's why. The best analogy I've ever, so tired analogy. It's the best way I've ever said it. Some of you young men have sat in the bar, as I did many, many years ago, sit in the bar late at night, have a drink, feel the omnipotence gradually growing, feel your holes gradually filling up, look across the room, see a miracle take place. Watch an old beast become beautiful by closing time. Might give little talks with your shoulders. Jimmy, send her over another glass of beer. Now, if I might go over to such an old queen at closing time, and I might imply there will be delights beyond her comprehension, if you'd like to join me in the old Chevy. And she would say, "No, what's wrong with you?" I wouldn't feel rejected when my holes are filled. I feel sorry for her. Too bad, bitch. Don't come begging tomorrow. If that would happen to me when I was sober and my holes were empty, I suppose I'd just go in the washroom and hang myself. That's the difference. Because alcoholics are people who use alcohol and use it badly and get in trouble. There are people like me whose case is different, unfortunately, who have the trouble and use the alcohol to get out of it. And it doesn't do me any good to go and hear a speaker say, "Once I stopped drinking, I put the plug in the jug and things began to get better and I felt solid and everything was wonderful. And I wish I were like you, pal. I wish I were simple." Sitting in my office in a big advertising agency in Dallas just before it all came down one more time and hearing my secretary say, "I was kind of lonely last night. I called up Betty and we went to the show and had a good time." That's not me. When I get lonely, I get so sad sometimes I can't bear to see anybody and I just go to bed and stay there. Why can't I be, and just to that secretary talk, I just want to shout, "I wish I was simple like you, you bitch. I wish I was simple. Why have I made so complex? What's wrong with me?" But I know one thing. I'm not going to go around saying there's something wrong with me because that makes it worse. You just have to learn to act and behave and try to decide what mask they want today and hopefully have a few drinks so that you can meet them on your own terms. And then drinking gets to be a problem. And well-meaning people came to me as they have come to you and implied your problem is alcohol. And deep in my mind I thought, "Jesus, I wish it was. I wish that was my problem. I wish I could stop drinking, I'd be all right." And I'd stop drinking. And it doesn't do any good. You go to AA and they're nice people, but they have no relationship. I have to try other things. I have psychoanalysis for several thousand dollars worth.
I went into metaphysics, I read books, I did a lot of things. But in all those years, I never found anything more effective than a few drinks. And I think that the number one thought in my life is the number one thought in all of our lives sometimes. It's the number one thought in the life of the man dying, and man and woman who are dying on Los Angeles Street tonight. You can get the best information and the best advice in the world and the best, all the data laid out in front of you. But the mind says, what you say may be true, pal, but you don't understand. My case is different. There's something different about me, and I would give anything to find out what the hell it was. I can't see it, but other people seem to be able to see it and silently react to it. And I didn't know what the hell they're doing. So you play different games and become ostentatious and stay repressed for a while and bust loose for a while and all sorts of things. And find things in your childhood to blame it on if you wish. But the net result is the same at 2 o'clock when you're looking off in the distance in the dark in your bed and you feel alive. You want to cry and you want your mother almost. You want to kill yourself and you want to run and you don't give anything just to have somebody, for Christ's sake, think I'm okay and make me okay. I'd do anything. And they promise you. They give you those promises. Go to this movement. Read this book. Go to this seminar. Do these things. It'll make you feel better. And for a while, when you're young and don't know anybody, you do that. But it doesn't. Somewhere, you hear it again and again, they seem to get a message I have never gotten. Where did they get it? Where was it they heard it? Why didn't I hear it? Now, I'm supposed to be successful, and I'm sitting in big offices, and I'm ordering people around, and I'm afraid they're going to find me out. That's all I know. And I drink, and I work very hard. You know, the best description of alcoholics of our kind, incidentally, let me digress for a moment, because there's a lot of conversations. Now, we hear these ads on the TV and radio sometimes about this hospital up in Seattle, who in 7 days can recover alcoholics from alcoholism. And apparently they've been able to do it with some people. Unless they wouldn't keep making that claim. There's this psychologist, or this doctor of philosophy up in Santa Barbara, who put out this thing about many alcoholics can drink again. Rand report in Los Angeles, 1970s. Alcoholics can drink again. And there seems to be, everybody who looks at it has a different look. What is it that maybe we're doing something wrong in AA? It is my belief, after studying it for a lot of years with my life on the line, so I studied it very closely, that the operative word is in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So once you accept that, there's no further question. Bill Wilson wrote, because it's the same problem during his day, alcoholics of our type. There may be people who are physiologically addicted to alcohol who can be withdrawn in 7 days and learn the evils of their ways and don't drink anymore. There may be people who drank a little too much and now they think they got a problem, but now the heat is off. But for the alcoholics of our type, those are people who are driven emotionally, physically, spiritually, who live, for whom sobriety is worse than drinking. That is one aspect of it. And the other aspect of it, today there's a lot of question about what's really an alcoholic. I'll tell you what's really an alcoholic. It's a person for whom alcohol changes their perception of the world. That's what an alcoholic is. It isn't how much you drank. It's the fact that you need to drink to make life acceptable. I'm sure that there are people who drink and use drugs, but using drugs never even occurred to me. I ran into people who use drugs, but I didn't understand why I want to use drugs, because alcohol did it. Why the hell would you want to smoke pot when alcohol gets you there? I mean, I understand today it's more of a peer thing. When I was using drugs, drug users were put in the penitentiary. You remember, in the late 1940s, Gene Krupa
was put in the penitentiary for possession of one cigarette. In Texas in 1950, an exotic dancer named Candy Barr, Byron probably remembers her, only because he's old, not because he didn't run with her. But that's why his wife wears candy striped dresses, just to remind him of her. But there's this Candy Barr, and they found two marijuana cigarettes in her glove compartment, and they put her in the state penitentiary for 10 years. Of course, they were cross with her anyway. You may need other drugs, you may want other drugs to go with, but I think the mark of an alcoholic is this. An alcoholic is a person for whom life is unbearable unless they drink, and then drinking changes it, and then drinking becomes unbearable. The best description, I've been reading descriptions of alcoholism for many, many years. I remember when alcoholism first became kind of an in thing. In the early 1960s, I was working in a medical corporation. It had been sober a relatively short time, 3 or 4 years. And the Yale Institute of Alcoholic Studies had put out their first massive report on alcoholism. And now for the first time in the medical journals, they were treating alcoholism as something that had to be treated. I remember the first ad I ever saw in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Doctors, now at last you can treat your alcoholic patients without fear of side effects. You can bring about cures. So, and I tell you, I was having a hard time, and my tongue darted out and licked the page just in case. And it really looked good, and they had great answers, and even had such a wonderful name, this first drug to apply to alcoholics. It indicated freedom. It said, you now can give them Librium. I thought, Jesus, how could I get them Librium? And then a few months after that, the first fallout Librium people got to AA. My doctor wants me to take this. Could you help me locate my mouth? And a whole cornucopia of drugs and all sorts of things. And people just forget they've been working on this problem for 5,000 years. And the one thing that the workers at it never understand, they never understand what alcohol does in the alcoholic. Because it has to happen to them. Just as much as I would like to understand, I cannot understand what sugar does in a diabetic, what the feeling is. They can tell me all day long. If I were a compulsive eater, I cannot understand why eating that sugar should change your metabolism. Just eat one piece of cake and let it go with that, for Christ's sake. I remember I spoke at about the second Overeaters Anonymous meeting that was ever held. They didn't have anybody's on maintenance yet. They were just meeting on Olympic. They had AA members come over and talk about the compulsions. And I stayed and listened to their little discussion. I almost puked. I never heard of anything like that, yeah. And then I ate the whole gallon of ice cream and couldn't hold anymore. Had to go to the bathroom and vomit it up to come back to eat the goddamn cake. And of course, I'm like, you shouldn't even eat, for Christ's sake. And I talked at the early Gamblers Anonymous meetings, the same thing. I lost everything, finally got a job for a year and got it all together again. And went down and started playing pan. And just went, I thought, Jesus, you know, you're on a losing streak. Why don't you quit? Yeah. And I'm sure that's the way people who want to help us look at us. I have a drink. I have a martini with you. Why do you then drink for the next 2 days and go crazy? Why don't you just drink like a human being? And if you are like me, you will go through your life never having an answer. Except that my case is different. I have these problems. Because I never knew that alcohol did a different thing for me than it did for them. Who would ever guess that? Who would ever guess that? I would never guess that. I hear people say, I drove a long way down the freeway drunk. And
I don't. That is, I could get my grandmother who never had a drink to do that if I get enough muscatel. Hey, Granny. I'm not like that. I'm not naturally a goof. But I studied alcoholism and all these treatments, and the best thing, now I look back, the best description of alcoholism I've ever read is the thing we hear in chapter 3 all the time. What do we all have in common? What do we all in this room have in common? The black guys and the white guys and the oriental people and the tall people and the short people and the religious people and the sinners and all the people together. What do we got? How much we drank? Not at all. Where we drank? Not at all. What it did to us? Not at all. Did we go to jail? Has nothing to do with it. Did we all lose something? Got nothing to do with it. Do you know what you and I have in common if you're an alcoholic of our type? You have, for reasons beyond your knowledge and without any cognizance of your own, been pushed into a situation in your life where you have had to defend an obsession that someday, somehow, I will control and enjoy my drinking. And I've got to believe that. Do you know why I have to believe that? Because without it, life is hopeless. And so we have talks in that page and a half. You get more knowledge about alcoholism than you will in all the learned tomes that you ever read. Occasional grief recoveries, followed always by a still worse relapse, inability to admit you're a real alcoholic, inability to admit you're different from your fellows, relapses till you get to what? Till you lose your family? No. Till your home? No. Till you reach the point that every one of us have been in, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And then you think, well, that's how you get so drunk. That isn't how you get when you're drunk. That's how you get after you're sober again. That's how sobering up brings about. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. A very, very high percentage, maybe 85%, of successful alcoholic suicides take place shortly after becoming sober again. That's when the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, because then the conflicts are back, and you cannot, you've now added to them, and everything is gone, and the long, dramatic notes written by drunken people rarely reflect the death. The guy hardly ever dies, or the woman ever dies. They always do something to call attention to their dying. That's when you're committing suicide to make them sorry. When you are literally psychotic from pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, there aren't any notes. There aren't anything. I just want to get out. I look at my life in Texas. One time my all-out effort to commit suicide, and I was successful. I didn't leave any notes. I didn't call anybody. I went to my family one way, and I parked the car in the garage, and I hooked up a hose, and I was sober. And I couldn't stand it. And I turned the motor, went to sleep, and died. And if the neighbor hadn't heard the motor running, and then notice I didn't come out, there was my little tedious, cheap tombstone in a grave in Texas, and I never would have lived long enough to understand there was a reason for my being that way. And I was dead when he pulled me out, and he had to get my heart started again. So that was close. But, and yet, the worst years of my life were to come. You'd think people would do better. And that's why on the morning of October 31st, 1958, I stood on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. My front teeth had just been kicked out in the Phoenix drunk tank. My clothes were gone. I was banned out of the mission. I couldn't go on the bus depot to get out of the rain because they were arresting me in the bus depot. Afraid. Almost feeling more comfortable than usual because it's almost when you feel so bad, there's something almost requiting in pain or something. It's almost as though you deserve it because you're so sinful. God, you're getting your punishment. I would have no idea that that would be the last morning I drank. Would I stop drinking again and go back in that house? What? And I walked 71 blocks through the rain, light rain, and walked to the 60 Club. I'm sure that John Locke, he was the only one here from that era. He was not the manager of the 60 Club, down there was a little bit later. And I walked in and I thought, if I had the slightest idea what was wrong with me, I, I'd have done anything. And it turned out all I had to do was the one thing that I thought I had done many times and I'd never done. All I had to do was get to a point where I would surrender. That's all it takes. And you make a surrender, and a lot of people made a surrender in this room, and a lot of people who used to be in this room and are drunk and dying and made a surrender too. Because the surrender is only the entree. What do you surrender? To put it back to that kind of silly analogy I used earlier, I must surrender to the fact that I know the wall is red, but I will try to act as though it's green, even though I don't see it that way, and it offends my logic. I allow someone or something to superimpose perceptions over mine that make me feel as though I'm selling out. Many times in my first year, I thought, this is the worst it's ever been. Not because I hadn't got anything, but something even worse. At least I've maintained my intellectual integrity until now. I may be going down, but with what I know to be right, and now I'm even selling that out. I'm acting like a stinking wimp. I'm acting like a brown noser to people. I'm acting like a goof. I hate myself for being like this, and yet they insist I do it. Because it turns out that there is a surrender here, but it's followed by another surrender, and it's followed by another surrender, and there's an endless, endless surrender. I made my most recent one yesterday on a matter that I felt intellectually sure, but I knew I was emotionally wrong. So I surrendered. Let it go. And it's a funny thing, no matter how long you've been sober, it's equally as hard to surrender. When you're new, you hate to surrender because you haven't got any experience at it. By the time you start doing good, you're doing too well to surrender. There's never any easy surrenders. Much of what sponsorship consists of is someone sharing with someone else how they can surrender instead of hanging on to a tattered flag that'll kill you. Again and again, throughout many, many things. Again, an analogy on this, the best I've ever been to think of. So often we talk about surrender in AA. I came here and I threw in the towel. And I've lived happily ever since. Show me how to do it, teacher. Nobody ever did it like that. Because humans don't. You throw in the towel. And when the heat is back, off you snatch it back. And you spend the rest of your life tearing off small strips and see if that'll satisfy the dirty bunch. And there's never any end to the towel. It's like Pinocchio's nose. It just gets the more you tear, the longer it gets. And what's the purpose of it? I'll tell you. The purpose of doing the things that make that wall turn green little by little, even when you've been sober a long time, wake up one morning and say, hey, that wall isn't green, it's red. I've been kidding myself. Great dividing line. A lot of people die as a result of that. Then you got to keep acting as though it's green, even though that day you see it's red. You must continue to surrender. And the purpose of it is not to become wonderful, and not to become holy, not to become wonderful. The purpose of it is to little by little begin to fill holes that only alcoholics know about that alcohol can fill. And I said that a little clumsily. To begin to fill holes that seem that only alcohol can fill in people like us. Alcoholics of our type. And no matter how wonderful you get, you never get to be very good. I know a lot of people in AA sometimes are disillusioned by old-timers because they haven't become wonderful. And they haven't become perfect. And they retain human flaws and fallibilities. And you just know that other places the old-timers are wonderful. Why in our group are they all goofy? I ran across an old letter that I want to read to you. See if you can hear my voice in it. That you seem disillusioned with me personally may be a new and painful experience for you. But many members have had that experience with me. Most of your pain has been caused not only by my several shortcomings, but by their own insistence on placing me, a drunk, trying to get along with other folks, upon a completely illusory pedestal, a station which no fallible person could possibly occupy. I'm sure you'll understand that I have never held myself out to anybody as either a saint or a Superman. I have repeatedly and truthfully said that AA is full of people who have made more spiritual progress than I ever have or can. That in some areas of living I have made some decided gains, that in others I seem to have stood still, and in still other ways I may even have gone backward. Let me tell you a tale about what it's like to be an old timer. That letter was written by Billy Wilson in 1960 to a group of people in Chicago who wrote and said he had disillusioned them because he wasn't perfect. Nobody's perfect. We've got to be very careful about perfectionism here. As long as you stay here, the motto is the same: progress rather than perfection. No matter how many times you fall short or come down again and again, you get up and you say, tomorrow will be better. I'll profit from it. John, the letter tonight, said he made a lot of mistakes. And he did, and so has everyone else in this room. But let me give you some hope, and you'll hear it again and again, but you better remember it. Making mistakes never got anybody drunk. Never got anybody drunk. You don't get drunk from making mistakes, ever. You get drunk from defending mistakes, of pretending you haven't made mistakes, of pretending to be an illusion of that you are really in possession of all the facts all the time and data, and that you don't do things emotionally. We all do things emotionally. We all do things that later we can look back and say, why the hell did I do that? That doesn't make you drunk. What makes people like you and me drunk is pretending we're not that way. Because it turns out, in the last analysis, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. One alcoholic of our type talking to another alcoholic of our type to reduce their feelings of being different, so they will take actions that they do not yet believe in and slowly bring about the change. I'm kind of a romanticist. As you know, 25 years ago, next week, this group started with 8 people and a speaker on Ohio Street. And I was secretary for a while, and I was not secretary. And for all these years, I've done this meeting, it's been my home group. And as some of you know, I'm going to be secretary again starting next week. But what made me feel sad tonight, this sounds silly. Every time you ever see me in this meeting, I'm sitting right back there. I was sitting in the middle of some of the worst people in AA, and I feel that I'm a lot. And I know everything, and I know everything in the world that I am. But still, there's some part of me, I wish I could go sit down with my feet and get back there and be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. The last thing I want to say, I've been saying a lot recently, a lot of people have heard it, so I'll say one more time, I won't say any more. In 1958, in 1949, when I first came to AA, and 9 years after that, when I slipped, and for the many years since then, one thing has been constant in AA. There's always been sharpshooters, always fringers, always people on the edges saying, hey, don't just, listen, AA is all right for your drinking problem. But if you have deep emotional problems, you better go to therapy X or take medication Y that can lead breakthrough in the treatment of alcoholics, or go to this good program that helps you to understand how hitting your parents can make you whole. And always some piece of crap like that. I have been in jail 34 times, which is not a world record. It's pretty good for an executive. I have been chained down in city hospitals. Once when my wife came in and had a baby and went home again, I was still there. I have been in padded cells in veterans' hospitals, cold, sober. I've been committed to spend the rest of my life to the Texas State Insane Asylum as an incurable schizophrenic depressive. I think I can speak on behalf of the emotionally upset. Speaking on behalf of the emotionally upset,
Let me say this tonight, as whatever testament I have to AA. Alcoholics Anonymous, as it is, its steps, its superimposed perceptions, its continual redirecting little directions, changing and getting back on the track thousands of times in every life, of picking up the phone and doing the things and being reliable and doing the things you said you would do, when you said you would do them, and be where you said you'd be, when you said you'd be there. If you will take these steps and do these things, you will discover Alcoholics Anonymous, as it is, in its present form, works at least 29 years and 7 months. It might not work any longer than that, but it'll work 29 years and 7 months, and it'll make you feel considerably better than those who say it doesn't. I suggest you stay here. Thank you.